The Radio Science Foundation presents Man with a Microphone, Part 3, The Avalanche.
If you've been to Salt Lake City, you know there are mountains just east of town. They're not really big mountains. The highest is 11,500 feet. But they are close mountains. They're like the playground in the city's backyard. In the summer, we hike and climb. In the winter, we hike and ski. And because Salt Lake City is both physically and culturally isolated from the rest of the world, we very often grow up here, learning our most important lessons not in school and not at home, but up in the mountains where we play. This story is about a backcountry ski tour that began in play but ended in tragedy. It happened 9 years ago. 7 young men went skiing, and there was an avalanche. 3 of them were caught in the avalanche, and 1 of them died. This is something that happens 2 or 3 times a year around here. Somebody dies in an avalanche. Some people say it serves them right for skiing in dangerous places. Others say it's a good way to go. Some people explain it by saying accidents happen, but then other people say there are no accidents. I interviewed 5 of the 6 survivors of this avalanche because I thought by hearing all their stories, I could learn more about how avalanches happen and how people get caught in them. I asked each of the 5 to tell me what they remembered of the day, from where they thought it began to where they thought it ended. And this is what they said.
Well, we could probably start at about 7 o'clock in the morning of April 2nd, 1979. We had had about 2 feet of fresh snow, if not more, maybe 30 inches of fresh snow had fallen in the previous day and a half. And we left our homes and went on up Big Cottonwood Canyon to a drainage called Mule Hollow.
So it's a pretty big party. Dwight, myself, Chris Larson, Alan, Greg McIntyre, a friend of Greg and Alan's from Maine, and Larry Olson from Oregon.
It was a very experienced crew. Everyone knew about avalanches. We all had peeps, which are avalanche beacons. We all had shovels. We all knew what to do, and we all knew the danger.
And the day started out with the tail end of a storm. And the clouds were like remnants, the last gasp of the storm trying to get up and over the Wasatch. It was a neat day, neat weather.
Oh, it was the best. It was a classic Wasatch tour where you start in one area, ski a run, hike up to another area, ski that, hike up somewhere else, ski something else, and it's too much fun.
It was Dwight's birthday, and we were sort of celebrating. We'd been having a real good time that day.
Beautiful weather, perfect skiing. You know, it's April 2nd. Really, really good snow.
Snow's flying over your head, and you're sort of down in it as much as skiing through it.
Face shot powder, even for me. Being 6'4", you know.
It was one of those periods where we just couldn't stop skiing.
So it was getting on towards sunset, or late in the day. You could tell the day was closing to an end, and out further out the ridge, not truly above Desolation Lake, but in a lower basin, there's a ridge that is pretty high above a lower basin just below Desolation, with a lot of shots on it, unskied, and you know, like to me, it was like the sirens calling us over there. And I have a real vivid image in my head of traversing out that ridge. It wasn't really a climb. We pretty much stayed at the same altitude, but it's kind of a broad ridge in some points. and a real vivid image of most of the party out in front of me and the sun going down and some really great sunset colors going on, or pre-sunset colors. Almost an alpenglow, but in my mind it's more violet than the red. And a few lingering clouds around. I mean, just a, you know, a it's pretty special or cosmic kind of a setting.
I was breaking trail, and it was out a ridge that we call Razor Ridge because it is a very steep ridge, and the slope falls off steeply on both sides. One is a south-facing side, and one is a north-facing side. And we were going to ski the north-facing side. I remember crossing the slope being very scared. Just worried sick, just being on top of it going, oh, you know.
I didn't feel good about it, you know. I mean, I just had a feeling. I didn't like it. You know, I didn't like the way it looked. It didn't look that bad when you're over on it. I mean, before you got on it. But once I was on top of it, I told Dwight, I said, let's spread out a little bit here. You know, just I yelled back to him, let's spread out a little bit. And I said, I don't really feel good about this. Let's go a little further down the ridge and let's look at something else.
It seemed to me there was no communication. That's because I was in my own space and not aware of group safety at that point or what might be presenting itself in front of us other than a great run.
I didn't think there's any communication about that. This is unsafe. Let's not ski it. If any of the members thought that the slope was unsafe, they certainly didn't let me know.
At this point, which is, you know, another learning thing, is that our group, without us knowing it, had split into two groups. The three of us, Dwight and Alan and I, were standing on top of one run we were about to ski, and the other four were already skiing the slope that we had crossed earlier that I was afraid to go near. We didn't even know it.
The first person to ski it, his name was Tim. Tim was out visiting from Maine, and he started down on the right side, but he cut way out onto the slope, traversing left and then cutting back. And I remember the group of us watching from above said, no, don't do that. Don't expose yourself so much to the open slope. Get back towards the trees. And he cut back to the right and stayed a little bit closer. When Greg went, we advised him to stay tight to the trees on the right-hand side, which he did.
So Greg and his friend skied down and waited in the fall line of the path that we were going to ski.
They were standing sort of on a mine dump, which would be sort of comparison to a ski jump, you know, that's got a little ramp up to the end, and they were standing out on this little point, I guess, in the assumption that was an island of safety, a place on the slope that you could stand where if an avalanche occurred, you'd be in a relatively safe spot.
So with that, I jumped into it, and skiing parallel style, so carrying pretty good speed. Made one turn, made another turn, and out in front of me I saw the snow fracturing and breaking up in blocks.
The first indicator that anything had happened was somebody yelling, avalanche, and we turned around and started running back towards where it was, and I remember looking down, seeing this huge dust cloud.
We could hear the cracking of the trees snapping in half.
And I was just blown away. I was going, oh my God, this is wild.
And all the snow's billowing up. It's like a big white cloud, and we could see Greg McIntyre and Tim. We could see him running, scurrying to get out of the way. But this thing was moving, I don't know how fast, probably 100 miles an hour at the bottom of the mountain, and it just engulfed him.
And it was a nasty, it was not, you know, not a really cut and dried slide path. I mean, it went, you know, it broke out fairly wide and then went down through a lot of trees and it spread out. And so it wasn't like you could just look and see it was in a confined path and you knew exactly where to look for the people, because you didn't. We all took our peeps out, and it wasn't real organized at that point because, you know, we're sort of in a state of shock. And we got down to the bottom, and Timmy Sears was standing on top of the snow, frantic, because there were three people caught in the avalanche, Dave, Greg, and Tim, and he was the only one standing on top. And he was, of course, you know, he'd been caught in the whole turmoil of the thing and ended up on top, and he was freaking out.
So I came to a stop, and yelled really loud. And so it was black, and I felt quite trapped, and then kind of got my presence of mind about, you know, my situation, and realized that that was stupid to have yelled because I needed to conserve my breath, and kind of relaxed and peed my pants because I was so tense. And I peed my pants and kind of got it together and said, well, you know, if I'm thinking to myself, if I'm going to survive this, then I have to really calm down and conserve my breath and not panic or struggle. And then as I calmed down, I tuned in. I could hear my peeps peeping away, and I thought, God, I hope those guys are quick. I'm glad I can hear my peeps.
A peeps, it's an avalanche transceiver. Everybody wears one on transmit all the time. As if somebody gets involved in an avalanche, everyone turns that's not involved, and it turns theirs to receive. It's not a directional device. So to track the person down, you have to use this bracketing technique where you go, you walk as far as you can to the point where the sound diminishes, and then turn around and in the exact opposite direction walk back to where the sound diminishes again. Then you have two points of equal low sound, and you walk to the middle. Going at 90 degrees, you do it again. And you continue doing that, and through this series of bracketing, you eventually locate the person. And at this point, things kind of get hazy in my memory, because I was trying to... I remember trying to imagine, you know, I'd been through one avalanche class at that point, so I sort of knew what to do, but I'd never really practiced anything enough for it to be instinctive. Dwight was with me looking for Dave. Alan was off on the side looking for Greg. He found Greg first and started yelling for help because he must have realized that Greg was in bad shape.
To get his face out, he was buried in a prone position, head downhill, or head uphill, but down. And his arms were completely spread out like this. You know, one arm, you know, sort of in a spread eagle position with his legs sort of wrapped back over his head. And so he didn't have any, he wasn't at all in a fetal position like Carter said he was buried, where you can you know, your diaphragm's more relaxed and you can have a little bit of reserve air in your lungs. He was completely the opposite, you know. So we were frantically trying to get him out, and we couldn't even pull him out before we got each arm out. I mean, it wasn't like we could roll him over because he was buried in such a strange position. You know, his head was way down, and his arms were both out the side, and he still had his ski pole straps on too. So you had to completely dig out each arm, pull his straps off to get his arm out, and then Greg's a big guy, so we had to pull him completely out of the hole and get him up on the surface. And then as soon as I got him up, I yelled for someone, we got to do CPR. And, you know, I started doing one-man CPR, and Tim didn't know how to do CPR, so one of the other, I think Chris Larson or somebody, came over and started doing CPR. We started doing two-man CPR, which is a lot more effective than one-man.
And it was really pretty pleasant. The state of unconsciousness was pretty pleasant, and peaceful. And it was, you know, had I died in that event, I would have been okay with it. I mean, I wasn't panicked, I wasn't remorseful, I wasn't seeing my life flash before my eyes. It wasn't an unpleasant experience. And I guess they must have, the guys that were digging me up must have disturbed the snow around me within a few feet of me before they actually got to me, because I heard them and I was again conscious. Oh, I just remembered. I just remembered something. I was lying there in the hole, and I think I must have still been trapped, and I could look up over the edge of this pit, and it was getting dark, but I just saw Dwight's head, just his head look into the hole, and he was like happy. You know, I responded to him, and he was pretty happy. And he was going, he was taking off for help. And then I realized that that Greg was in trouble, and Alan and some of the other guys in the party were working on Greg and trying to revive him. And I must have wandered around and pretty dazed for a while these guys were trying to revive Greg. And I think I must have come back to the group occasionally and helped or done something. Because one real strong impression I have is I can only describe it as knowing inside that Greg had died, and a real strong image and feeling of his spirit departing.
And it was getting dark by this time, and so we sent, it didn't, you know, we definitely were going to, Greg was not coming too. We couldn't get a carotid pulse, which is the carotid artery right next to the throat. We couldn't get a pulse, and it was really frustrating. I mean, that was probably, it was definitely the most frustrating experience of my life, you know, doing the CPR and just the whole search, because in my heart and in my soul, I knew he was dead. And, you know, even before, you know, I knew he was dead.
We took turns doing CPR on Greg while Dwight went out for help. He ended up getting a hold of Alta Central. They sent out a helicopter with a dog, the doctor, and one of the assistant snow safety director at Snowbird. Once the doctor got there, they decided, you know, they decided he was dead, and they flew us all out at that point in the helicopter back to Silver Fork Lodge. And by that point, the television crews were at Silver Fork Lodge. We got out in full force of the lights, and it was a really weird experience.
There was quite a scene. Coming from that place, I just remember a lot of lights and vehicles and news people and that kind of stuff. And so they took us into Silver Fork, and we had some cocoa or coffee and gave a brief report to the police and the snow ranger. And they dismissed us and sent us home. And I remember the last, you know, the closing of the event for me was going home and sitting in a bathtub. And just noticing how much pain I had in my both big toes, which a couple days later turned black and blue. And to me, that was, you know, kind of closing the day. And there's a lot of feelings and history and relationships and stuff that are affected since then. But that's how I remember the day and the event.
You've been listening to The Avalanche. This program was produced by Scott Carrier, Senior Consulting Editor Larry Massett. Funds provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting through National Public Radio's Satellite Program Development Fund.